Joining me now from Bangor is Dr. Julia Jones. And here in the studio, I have Dr. Ivan Scales, who have both worked in Madagascar. Julia Jones is a senior lecturer in conservation at the University of Bangor and is particularly interested in how local people interact with natural resources. Ivan Scales is a lecturer in human geography at the University of Cambridge, who's studying how economics and politics affect conservation decisions. Now, welcome to you both. Ivan, we do have this idea of Madagascar as being this unspoiled place, untouched by man until relatively recently. Is that accurate?
It's a lot more complicated. First of all, there's been recent archaeological evidence that pushes back our understanding of human arrival to Madagascar to about 2,000 years BC. It was one of the last significant land masses on Earth to be colonised by humans. And if we look at various sources of evidence, it suggests that Madagascar's never been entirely forested. Over the last 20,000 years, that's before humans arrive, there's been a complex dynamics of vegetation change, grasslands expanding, contracting, forests expanding and contracting. Now, when humans arrive, there is evidence of significant landscape change.
But if there has been ebb and flow across the centuries, are we taking that into account?
Yes, forest has expanded and contracted, but over timescales of thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years. And animals can move, species can adapt, they can speciate. This is on a much shorter time scale. So in fact, my research looked at rates of forest loss in the west of Madagascar for a 100-year period. So starting with the beginning of the colonial period and moving right through to 2005. And what I found was actually most of the forest that was lost in the west of Madagascar was lost during the colonial period. So more forest was lost, in fact, in a three-year, four-year period of forest clearance than was lost between 1954 and 2005. It's not to say that forest loss isn't important now, but I think we need to understand some of the historical context of what's gone on here. What the French colonial period showed is that if a state and if corporate interests, these were concession owners, want to clear forest, then they can, and they can do it on a very large scale, and they can do so much more rapidly than poor indigenous farmers.
Well, I mean, Julia, what is the position now, in objective terms, for wildlife in Madagascar? Where are we at?
So I think there's a lot of very justified concern about Madagascar's forests. So forests, although, you know, the idea that Madagascar was somehow some kind of forested Eden has been shown to be wrong. You know, there has always been grasslands, there's always been a mixture of habitat in Madagascar. Forests are the kind of bastion of biodiversity in Madagascar, and they have been rapidly eroded over the last 100 years. Hunting has also expanded, and many species are really critically threatened and really are on the edge of extinction. That really is just a fact. What isn't a fact and what isn't simple is what should be done about it and how these really very urgent conservation threats in Madagascar can best be addressed.
I think the starting position has to be that you are dealing with one of the poorest countries on Earth. So as the report piece mentions, that one of the drivers, not the only driver, I'd like to add, which is what my research focuses on, but one of the main drivers of forest loss is Sweden. I prefer to call it Sweden agriculture rather than slash and burn. There's nothing inherently destructive about Sweden cultivation. It just depends on how long the forest is given to recover. The problem is, it's not being given that time to recover. So the main driver is poverty. Households don't really have a choice but to clear the forest.
People's day-to-day lives involve the use of the natural resources around them in absolutely every aspect. If you're talking about communities living on the edge of the forest, the community that I was with last week around the edge of Zarmen National Park in the northeast of Madagascar, all their houses are made of bamboo, of wood, thatch roofs. They need to be able to get those resources from the forest. So they're dependent on forest being there, but also their agricultural system depends on clearing land and having this rotation. Now, of course, the problem is, at low population density, that agricultural system works fine, but currently populations are growing fast, and that puts a real pressure on things.
What is increasing the population? How quickly is this happening?
Madagascar's population is growing at 3% a year. The thing that's interesting about Madagascar is that it doesn't seem to be undergoing the same sort of rapid urbanisation that other parts of sub-Saharan Africa are. More than 70% of Madagascar's population is rural, and a large proportion of that is subsistence. So these are mostly rural agriculturists growing food to feed their own families.
And is there any projection on at what point this is going to become unsustainable for people, let alone for Wild West.
You could argue it's unsustainable now.
Okay. So presumably, Julia, if it's arguably unsustainable for people, lemurs are being squeezed and pinched out of already.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think, Niven's already said, things are very complicated. Things are very complicated. Our research showed there's been a big change in the amount of hunting, particularly if we focus just on the injury, showing that in one village, one of our team was spending a lot of time in one particular village and started to notice huge numbers of injury, dead injury, being transported through the village, and started keeping count and started to look into it a bit more detail. And we recorded something like 150 injury over a few month period. Now, of course, that's a completely unsustainable number for a species such as the injury, which, you know, only reproduces once it's 4 or 5 years old, has one young every few years. And we were thinking, well, this can't have been going on for long. This must be a new phenomena. And it seemed to be that the spread of illegal gold miners into the area that lacked the traditional local taboo or fad that protected the lemurs had resulted in a very rapid social change where hunting of lemurs had become socially acceptable even amongst the local community. And in fact, the elders held a ceremony to officially get the taboo removed because they were concerned about their own youth getting involved in lemur hunting if it was going to upset the ancestors. So social change in Madagascar is very, very rapid, and that's putting a lot of pressure, of course, on natural resources.
Julia, you've just returned from a trip to Madagascar. What were you doing there this time?
So on this trip, I was working with my colleagues at the University of Tana as part of a project looking at how paying for global ecosystem services can influence poverty in Madagascar. So, for example, increasingly people offset their carbon when they fly, and that money is being used to try and avoid deforestation in places like Madagascar. And that sounds like a great win-win. It's good for the environment, good for local people, because there's money transferring to places like Madagascar. But of course, it's always a lot more complicated than that. And there's real issues and concerns about the impact on local people because of these new carbon payment projects.
Such as?
Wherever money gets involved, it always changes power relations. So if, for example, you've got local people whose livelihood is based on slash and burn agriculture, and now there's global entities willing to pay the Malagasy government if that slash and burn agriculture can be stopped, there's a risk, of course, that coercion might be used and that enforcement of laws that might exist but might not currently be enacted might suddenly be enforced without giving those people a proper alternative.
So it sounds as though you'd be paying people not to do things rather than to do things.
So this is quite a big change, really, in global environmental policy. It's happening all over the world. There's a lot of interest in this idea that you can pay to avoid deforestation. But the level at which you're paying, you might not be paying individuals, you might be paying a government. So it might be that a government such as Brazil or Papua New Guinea or Madagascar gets large payments if they can show that they have reduced deforestation in their country. So it's not necessarily the person holding the axe at the edge of the forest that's getting a payment to change their behaviour. It might be that a country gets paid if they can change the behaviour of their citizens.
And if they don't get paid, then behaviour is not going to change.
But the biggest issue, of course, is the land tenure in a situation like Madagascar, where people who are actually physically cutting the forest might not own the forest in any kind of legal status. In fact, they almost certainly don't in most cases in Madagascar. It's very difficult to work out who gets paid and how those payments should be made. These areas are incredibly remote. Maps are terribly weak and terribly poor. When we survey areas, we find villages that don't appear on any maps. So it just makes the transaction costs of actually making payments in local areas extremely, extremely difficult.
Ivan, we've heard a number of references to political change and upheaval in Madagascar. Not everybody will know about that. Can you explain it?
Yeah, so Madagascar gained its independence from the French colonial powers in 1960, and it's pretty safe to say that it hasn't really enjoyed any protracted period of stability since then. The last 10, 15 years have been particularly unstable. In 2001, there were contested elections. One president got voted in, the other one didn't want to go, established an alternative capital for a while, and then finally it settled down, mostly because of international pressure. So that was 2001. 2009, there was a coup d'etat, and Marc Ravalomanana was ousted and escaped to South Africa. So we've had a lack of political stability, and that feeds directly into conservation. It feeds into a lack of policing, of monitoring, especially in protected areas. Madagascar has also suffered economically as a result. A lot of donors withdrew their funding from Madagascar in protest. In fact, Madagascar, I think, was kicked out of the African Union as a result of that. So it's hurt economically. It's also hurt in terms of resources for funding conservation, of course, and it's also created somewhat of a political vacuum, which has led to increases in illegal logging, wildlife trading, bushmeat hunting, which has affected lemurs, because they're all connected.
Julia, can you give any more details on the conservation result of this?
There's a lot of people saying that the political crisis in 2009 has driven increase in bushmeat hunting and has driven real problems for conservation. And I think that's very true when you think about issues like the logging in some of the rainforests for the exportation of the very, very valuable rosewood. That has massively increased as a result of the political crisis because...
Is this illegal logging you're talking about?
This is illegal logging, literally billions and billions of dollars worth of... Very, very valuable tropical hardwoods have been exported to China and other countries because it's been able to get out of the country, partly due to the political power vacuum.
Well, thank you to both of you, Julia Jones and Ivan Scales. Thank you very much indeed.